This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. And there's an audience with us here in the night studio. And thank you all very much for coming in. Appreciate it. 3 women friends, widowed in their 60s and 70s, returned together to an old summer haunt in a small town in Rhode Island. The women, it should be said, are witches. And the town is Eastwick. Novelist John Updike has returned to one of his most popular worlds almost 25 years after the publication of The Witches of Eastwick. He's released his characters from their marriages. They are now the widows of Eastwick. Age mellows them somewhat and reduces their powers as they test the themes John Updike is most famous for: love, power, and aging in modern America. Later in the program, Power on Another Plane, we'll continue our series of final arguments for president. Sarah Sewell makes the case for Barack Obama on foreign policy. But first, John Updike, one of our best-known writers, a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winner, and also one of our most prolific, with scores of novels, short stories, poems, reviews, and essays to his credit. And he joins us today in the Newseum. And welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
If you'd like to talk with John Updike, give us a call. Our number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And some might think it a curious choice to write a novel with 3 protagonists, all of whom are women in their 60s and 70s.
Well, yes, it is odd, but then every novel has something odd about it, and that's part of the charm, at least for the writer, if not for the reader. A sequel, I've done a lot of sequels. I never thought I'd be a sequel writer, but I brought back Rabbit Angstrom after 10 years and then 10 more and 10 more. The thing about a sequel is that you've done a lot of the work already. You've invented the characters, named them, invented the place, named it, and you're able now to add with a sequel a dimension of time. It seemed to me that I asked myself, well, what do I know now that I didn't know in my other fiction, and I know that I'm older, and so the witches presented themselves to me as possibly a way to write about old age and aging and losing your powers, including that of witchery.
And including the powers of witchery. You described the first novel as an attempt to make things right with my, what shall we call them, feminist detractors.
Yes, I did say that rather indiscreetly, and I shouldn't be too aware. A writer can't really worry too much about the critics because there's no pleasing some of them and there's no displeasing others in you. But I was startled enough to be told that I was a misogynist to reflect and try to write, which is, I thought I would, you know, the charge was that I had all these male, sex-hungry, chauvinistic male characters.
So you wrote a bunch of sex-hungry female characters.
I tried to write about some women, and the women have power, they have abilities, they are artists, each in their way, and I hope that would placate my critics, but it didn't. In fact, they found it a little more offensive than ever, but I didn't mean to be offensive. I really wrote with, I thought, a very fond heart and a real interest in their fates, and did some research about witchery. And I hate to say it was a fun book, but it was a fun book for me. And when I reread it in preparation for writing this sequel, I was surprised by how much was in it. You know, there really was a lot of content there.
Kid could write.
Not bad, I said to myself.
Do you ever wish that, you know, you'd cashed in on that witchcraft thing? You know, maybe set it in a high school somewhere?
good idea. No, it never occurred to me. And I sort of, when I came to write the sequel, I discovered I'd forgotten most of the witchcraft I once knew. But the idea was is that their witchery had faded, and they now viewed that era, the former era, with distaste because they had not only bewitched people but done a fair amount of damage. They'd killed a couple people. So they've, in a somewhat more chastened and repentant mood, they go back to Eastwick, see how the town has fared in their long absence, and in a way, try to make amends.
The first third of the book, though, you reintroduce us to your characters, and in a way, it's an odd form of writing because you have readers who, of course, know the characters extremely well. You have readers who only know them through the movie, which would be a mistake because they're quite different than they are in the book.
Thank you.
And
yes.
you have readers who don't know them at all. So it's a curious form of how much can you tell us about their backstory without boring some people to tears.
I tried to do it just right, you know, a little backstory, and maybe not too much. When you think about what do old people in this country, in this state of global development, do, is that I discovered as I aged that you travel. And so I put first one witch on a trip to Canada, two witches on a trip to the Nile, and the three witches altogether to China. So that seemed to me to be a fair summary of normal American activity in old age.
So was this also a way to write off all your trips to Canada, Egypt, and China?
I haven't taken any deductions. I confess I have been to all three places and did use some of my memories and some guidebooks to get me through. I tried not to make it sound too much like a guidebook, and maybe it is a little guidebooky, but the fact is Americans now must live with the consciousness of the wider world. And like good students, a lot of us are trying to learn about the globe before we pass on.
I have to say they are charming travel companions. They're a lot of fun. But I wanted to read a short passage from your book just to ask you a little bit about writing. Alexandra glimpsed a possibility of breaking out of her widow's monotonous life, pushing through her book club's monthly choice of literary fiction, having drinks and Dutch treat dinners with her Taoist girlfriends, leaving querulous messages on the telephones of her evasive children, fighting her weight with cheek-stinging hikes in the high ranch country north toward the Wheeler Peak. Her only companion, the arthritic old black lab she and Jim had raised from a puppy they called Cinder because of his ash-gray fuzziness, his eyes the wonderstruck white glass of a husky's. In Eastwick, her lab had been called Cole.
Nicely read.
Nicely written. Is that a technique you stole from Homer? I mean, the long, discursive, wonderfully rambling sentence, and then that short, punchy one.
It did sound not too long-winded, but it sounded long-winded enough. I think, you have to vary prose and go from long sentences to short ones, and I've never been shy about long sentences. Often I find there's even more you want to crowd in somehow. One clause, one phrase breeds another. But in that one, it's sort of an enumeration of her life. After all, in one sentence, I'm trying to tell you what a 72-year-old woman out in New Mexico does with her day. So in that sense, I think it's okay, and it gets us over the terrain, and then we can, having met Alexandra, we can go on to follow her in her later travels.
We're talking, of course, with John Updike, the author most recently of The Widows of Eastwick. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And why don't we begin with James, and James calling us from Parkersburg in West Virginia.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm going through the Rabbit series now, Mr. Updike. I love it very much. I read The Witches of Eastwick quite a while before the movie came out, and I had Jack Nicholson in mind for Satan right from the very start, and I was really startled when the movie came out that he had actually been cast the role. And I've always wondered whether that was something that you had in mind when you wrote the book.
No, I was invited. Once you sold the movie, once you sold the book for the rights, movie rights, I was invited to participate as kind of an advisor, and I backed off. I figured that a writer is really a moth lost in the bright lights of Hollywood, and I'd do better to try to write another book than to in any way advise or correct the movie. A movie has to be quite unlike the book, and indeed that movie was quite unlike the book. The longer it went on, the less like the book,
it
became. And they left out all of the violence that I mentioned earlier. Nicholson, you can't fault. He's a wonderful actor. Role after role, he comes through. And he did in that one. I thought the script let him down at the end. There wasn't really enough for him to do, and so it fell to the special effects directors to think of how to fill the screen. And also the actresses were all lovely. Cher, always lovely. Susan Sarandon, and the then quite new to the screen, Michelle Pfeiffer. So you can't complain about the cast. But I did think that the movie misrepresented the book enough that I could write a sequel in part to erase the memory of the movie.
Where did you see the movie for the first time?
I saw it only once. I saw it in a theater in Danvers, Mass., near where I live. My wife and I snuck into an afternoon show, and about halfway through the film, she rested her head on my shoulder and said, "Oh, John, you must get your name taken off this." I didn't think it was that bad, but anyway, she's kind of a perfectionist. I thought it was in many ways a noble attempt to One is grateful on the one hand to have interest from Hollywood, but seeing the versions that they produce is sort of embarrassing. I felt like I'd put these very talented actors and other artists in a kind of a glass box of my feeble imagining, and I wanted to break the glass and get them out of the movie somehow, but of course I couldn't, and we left the theater without. I mean, we saw it through to the end, and never mentioned it again.
James, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks for taking me.
Bye-bye. And let's see if we can get Carl on the line. Carl's with us from Tuscaloosa in Alabama.
Yes, Mr. Updike, a pleasure to talk to you. A somewhat different question. I'm sure you're familiar with the writer Patrick O'Brien of the Aubrey Maturin series. You mentioned sequels at the beginning. And after writing 19 books before he died, I wondered if you might like to comment on the work of Patrick O'Brien, and I would be very interested in your thoughts.
Well, you embarrass me because I've never read a book by him. I remember, of course, the name, and they're seafaring books, aren't they? They're about adventures at sea. And,
during the Napoleonic Wars. Yes,
during the Napoleonic Wars, and I can't claim to have read them, but sure, if I had read them, I would have enjoyed them. A series I did read was the Flashman series, which again took place in Victorian England and was very entertaining. Sequels, as I say, have the charm of having a stable set of characters, basic characters, and you can watch them function through time in a way you rarely can with a single novel.
Carl, Patrick O'Brien was a guest on this program to talk about his books and take calls from listeners. I guess we could go through the archives and get you a copy I don't know how we would get it to you, but write us an email. We'll see if we can get you a copy of it.
I will do it. Thank you very much for taking my call.
All right,
thank
Carl.
You.
Thanks very much. We're talking today with John Updike. His new book is titled The Widows of Eastwick. If you'd like to speak with him about his writing and his career, 800-989-8255. You can also send us an email. Carl should do that. The address is talk@npr.org. A bit later in the show, we'll ask him for his take on this American moment, so stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting today from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C. We're talking with John Updike after more than 50 books. His latest is a follow-up to the best-selling Witches of Eastwick. If you'd like to read more about how the witches have fared over the last 30 years, you can find an excerpt from The Widows of Eastwick on our website at npr.org/talk. And if you'd like to talk with John Updike about his novels, his criticism, or his career, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And I wanted to ask you that Margaret Atwood, in the review of your first book, The Witches of Eastwick, not your first book, but the first in this series, said that in some ways the town itself was the main character.
That's how I felt it. Yeah, that was a very nice review, by the way. Margaret Atwood, you mentioned the feminist critics, and here was a woman writer of great distinction who came out with a very kind and generous and witty review of The Witches of Eastwick. Yes, the town. Several towns have meant quite a lot to me in my life and in my fiction. I've named one of them Olinger, was the Pennsylvania town, basically, in which I grew up, and another was Eastwick, which under various stands for the town in which I kind of became, with some difficulty, an adult. So living in New England for a Pennsylvania-born boy has always been a slightly strange experience. I moved there to get away from New York City and to find a little space that I could call my own, and it's been very good to me, really. And I love New England, but I've never been at home there. And so the details of a New England town and the seasideness of it and the brininess of it and the antiquity of it, I mean, the history going back to 1630, that's a lot of history for America. All that interested me, and I did dramatize, tried to make the town real, and in the second book I tried to make it just as real or even realer. It has a kind of voice in the second novel. This sort of Puritan voice breaks in the notion that there is a Puritan darkness at the bottom of this New England resort town.
She also said in that review, Margaret Atwood, that this was an opportunity for you to fill a lifelong fantasy of being a woman. Was that the witty part?
That was among the witty parts. And sure, there's been a, you know, one wants to be a woman or an old man when you're young, or a young man when you're old. One wants to use the advantages that fiction presents of becoming other people to some degree. So, of course, crossing the gender line is one of the chief tests, and you can't be a novelist without crossing it some way or other. And you must, even if you don't ever enter into the brain of the female character, you must give her things to say and things to do. So in some sense, you're identifying. And yes, I enjoyed being, insofar as I successfully entered into their spirits and their bodies even. I enjoyed trying to be a woman, a guy among these three gals. And that was true of the third book, the second book also. Again, it was nice to be back in their company, even though they had aged 30 years. I, too, had aged 30 years, so it wasn't that bad.
I wanted to, we'll get the listeners, get more listeners on in just a moment, but I did have to ask you, you described the witchcraft that they do at one point as a sort of half-baked suburban variety of witchcraft, and it turns out later in the book you say that Eastwick itself could provide many of the materials needed for this particular line of work.
Yes, the raw materials you need, certain knives and magic candles and perfumed candles and all that can be obtained.
And a box of Cascade. I think that's the suburban part.
The box of Cascade was used to outline the magic circle that their coven or their sabbat takes place in. Yeah, well, you have to use the materials around you, and these are suburban women, and I tried to be as inconspicuously ingenious as I could in using what was around to use.
Let's get David on the line. David's calling us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to thank Mr. Updike for a story he wrote very early on called Pigeon Feathers. And that story was shared with me by a teacher when I was in my late teens, and I was in a period of having a hard time connecting with my parents' Protestant faith and trying to find my own path. And it gave me a lot of encouragement and hope.
Thank you, and I'm glad to hear it. I do think, in all modesty, that's one of my better stories, and it certainly was a heartfelt story from my standpoint. I wrote it years after the events in confirmation class that inspired it, but they remained pretty vivid with me. And, I put a lot of myself into that story, and the New Yorker took it. It was slightly cut, actually, in the New Yorker, because I had much more about the parents quarreling in it. The New Yorker didn't like too much quarreling. The uncut, I don't know what version you read, but the version in Pigeon Feathers is the book Pigeon Feathers is the one that I'd like you to read.
Excellent.
Thanks for the call, David. We have a question from the audience here in the museum.
Hi, Mr. Updike. This is somewhat along the lines of both religion and witchcraft. Back in the 50s, you wrote another story, perhaps not a favorite, called The Christian Roommates, about some of your real roommates at Harvard. And one of them had a nervous breakdown in this story, and we know that madness and witchcraft have long been associated. And I just wanted to let you know that he grew up to become my high school English teacher. He converted to Judaism, but he's now teaching at a Catholic college. So I would hope that you would write a follow-up on his story, too.
I don't want to intrude on your or my privacy, but this isn't Reg Hannaford, is it?
It is Reg Hannaford.
It is
exactly.
Reg Hannaford. Okay, right. I'm glad he recognized himself without pain and survived it. And I had a fairly colorful set of roommates and housemates when I was in college, and I did write, as you say, about a variety. Meeting religious questions is something you do in your late teens or college years, I think, often. And certainly Reg took his introduction to Kierkegaard quite hard. And
We all have.
he's not an easy man to meet, you could say. That is also a unique story in my work, in that although I attended Harvard for 4 years, and it was a very formative experience for me and a not unpleasant experience, I've only written one story about it, and that's the one, The Christian Roommates.
Thanks for the question. Let's see if we can get, this is Michael. Michael's on the line with us from Moke Hill in California.
Good afternoon. Mr. Updike, my basic question is, are you a happy person, a happy man? Because the reason I ask is because so many times you read about famous authors like yourself who are quality crafters of stories, and you find out in their autobiography, they were really miserable people. And their writings didn't show that. They really put on remarkable stories about that intertwine between the male-female relationship? And the other part of my question is this criticism. I find there's kind of a double standard where men write about women and they're very criticized for it, whereas women write about men and they're not so criticized for it. And I wonder if you'd like to touch on that.
Yeah, I'll begin with the second one. Yeah, I think it's a double standard, all right. But something political happens when a man tries to act or be or imitate a woman that doesn't happen when a woman crosses over and tries to do a man's point of view. The British women, who I think aren't as afraid of being manly, seem better. Iris Murdoch and Muriel Spark both write a lot about male characters and always very convincingly to me. I have no trouble with it. And as I say, I think a novelist, fiction writer of any sort, has to attempt to cross the gender line above all. As to my happiness, I think of myself as quite a fortunate and happy person. I was a happy child, my mother tells me, and I'm glad to be able to be a writer. It's what I wanted to be, some kind of artist as a child, and I have become that. I've actually done better than he thought possible. I love life. I love being alive. I love being an American. So all these things are, I think, would make me a happy person. I'm not happy about the fact that I'm aging and getting older and losing my fastball and going to die before too very long. So, but if you love life, I think you have to reconcile yourself to the darker side of being a mortal creature.
Well, that's very true. And I really appreciate all your work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. On American, here's a good email from Bodie in California. I'd like to know Mr. Updike's reaction to Horace Engdahl's recent statement. Of course, there is powerful literature in all big cultures, but you can't get away from the fact that Europe is still the center of the literary world, not the United States. The U.S. is too isolated, too insular. They don't translate enough and don't really participate in the big dialogue of literature. That ignorance is restraining.
Yes, I've heard that quoted more than once, especially lately, since I've gone on the road with my own book. I think there's something in it. To be fair, we are big but provincial, and always have been provincial. We were isolated here, more or less, with oceans on either side of us, and much of the charm of American literature is its provincial, quirky, cranky qualities. It's not like European literature. European literature in general, if you can make a generalization, is about society, people reacting, interacting in society. We tend to write about loners or couples like Huckleberry Finn and Jim going down in the Mississippi, write about people looking, trying to find a white whale that infuriates them and is dangerous. And so, yes, the kind of quest that it is an American quest is not quite the European one. I rather doubt that having more translated and would enable us to participate in the dialogue that he mentioned. I don't know quite what goes on in that dialogue. I think that people who care can certainly read enough translation, and they also can learn the language in which the book was written. If they, I began when I was a critic, a young man, and began to write criticism. I was especially interested in what European writing was doing because I thought it was different and more thoughtful.
Well, this was this
more
this,
theoretical. Yes,
some have put this in the context of the comment that there are no American writers worthy of the Nobel Prize writing today, and so some of us might be able to think of somebody in this room who might be worthy of such an honor. But yourself accepted, might you think of others Americans who might want to be considered for a visit to Scandinavia?
I can think of a number of American writers who would not disgrace the prize, and the prize has gone to a number of people that Americans, by and large, have never heard of. So, sure, I think Don DeLillo and Philip Roth and some others maybe could be considered. But my own work, as I judge it, is too provincial, too American, too concerned with bringing out the intricacy and interest of ordinary lives. And this has been a project of mine and one I've lived by, but I'm not sure it's going to attract. It doesn't have quite the bells and whistles that the Nobel Committee is looking for.
Our guest is John Updike. His most recent book is a novel called The Widows of Eastwick, updating the story from the that he first wrote about 25 years ago. He's joining us here in the Knight Studio at the Newseum. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Witches of Eastwick. Now that name came to me. I'm Neil Cunningham. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get one last call in, and we'll go to Mark, and Mark's with us from St. Augustine in Florida.
Hello there, Mr. Updike.
Yes.
Glad to meet you, sir.
Thank you.
I have a comment, and then I'd like to ask a question. When I was about 10 years old, I read a book my mother had called Rabbit Run. And, of course, I was slipping through it trying to find the good parts. And it seemed like all the books that came out in the 60s and all that were trying to bust the envelope. And my question is for you is, at this stage in your game, are there envelopes to push open anymore? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Mark, thank you.
That is quite a good question, almost too good for me to answer. But you're right, Rabbit Run was an attempt to slightly push the envelope of sexual explicitness, sexual realism, really, because although sex has been described in this and that work, Lawrence, Joyce, others, Henry Miller, to integrate it with the normal flow of middle-class experience, to really describe what happens, this strange dreamlike thing we do, seemed to me to be a worthy enterprise and one that hadn't quite been carried out before. So for me, that was a bit of an adventure, and I'm not ashamed of it. Envelopes to push, it's sort of hard to tell until you've seen them pushed, but I do think the big problem, in a way, for a fiction writer is how do you deal with ordinary life that is not extraordinary, that does not involve heroism, that does not involve a crisis, really, but the way in which we are alive is meaningful, and it does have a certain radiance, the beauty of the actual. So that's what I keep pushing at, whether or not it's a envelope that has already been slit wide open, I don't know.
We just have a couple of minutes with you left, but since the start of the Democratic Convention in August and ever since, we've been asking any number of politicians, writers, thinkers about this particular moment in the history of this country as we face an election now 6 days away. And I wanted to ask you briefly to step back from partisan politics and just to comment, if you would, on what you think is at stake in this American moment, if you will.
I think it's an interesting election, and I will keep my partisan feelings out of it, although they may peep through, in that we have no present incumbent running, and so we have, in a way, a clean slate, and we're more conscious than usual, I think, of the choices as far as approach, style, doctrine go. It certainly looks like an election that a lot of people are going to vote in, and that's a good thing in a democracy. America notoriously has been one of the poorest voting turnouts of any industrialized country, and I think it'll be a good turnout for this. And it was nice to see a black man and a white woman fighting for the nomination. It hasn't been so many years ago, and that would have been unheard of. And now it is not only heard of, but it's happening. So I think it's, in a way, a very hopeful moment for America. The century is young. We still feel like a young country, although we're not anymore. And I'd like to think we're embarking with this election upon a fresh path.
On a fresh path, you say you sound very optimistic at a moment when, given the financial chaos around us, so many people are uncertain.
Yeah, I'm not sanguine about that, and we've all felt a bite of this. We're all a little less rich than we thought we were, but I somehow think that 10 years from now, or even 2 years from now, it'll be seen as just one more bump in the financial ups and downs, which are part of capitalism. Maybe I don't think it's the end of the world, funnily enough, although they tell us pretty close to it.
Well, we'll have you back in a couple of years to see how it worked out for
all
you.
All right, it's a date.
John Updike's new book, The Widows of Eastwick. He joined us here in the Knight Studio at the museum, and we thank him very much for his time. Coming up, the next in our series of final arguments for the candidates for President of the United States, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Sarah Sewell makes the case for Barack Obama on foreign policy. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As the presidential election approaches, we've asked four people to make the case for the two major party candidates on foreign and domestic policy. Earlier this week, we heard from Michael Gerson and John McWhorter on domestic issues. In a moment, Sarah Sewell, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and a senior foreign policy advisor to the Obama campaign, will join us to tell us why she supports the Democratic candidate on foreign policy. On tomorrow's program, we'll hear from former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger for John McCain. Obama supporters, make the case for your candidate on foreign policy. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can post your final argument on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Sarah Sewell is the faculty director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard, a senior foreign policy advisor to the Obama campaign. During the Clinton administration, she was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Peacekeeping and Humanitarian Assistance, and she joins us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
How would you describe Barack Obama's national security strategy, and what appeals to you about it?
Well, Barack Obama starts from the premise that the 21st century is a really different place than the world during the Cold War era. And I think that's the fundamental point of departure for him, both in terms of distinguishing him from the current Bush administration and distinguishing him from his opponent in the general election. I mean, this is a 21st century in which we have a really different set of challenges to face as a nation, and the work of keeping Americans safe and keeping the country secure is more complex and much more of a challenge that requires really wise judgments. The old approaches from the Cold War, in which the world was divided into black and white, and in which the use of military force was really how we thought about the conduct of foreign policy, simply won't wash. It won't sustain American leadership, and it won't keep Americans safe. So I think he starts from a premise that the world has really changed, and we need a leader that understands the world as it is today, not the world as they wish it were.
He early on in the campaign said that he would meet with the leaders of rogue nations in the first year of his presidency, and he's backed off some of that in more recent statements. Nevertheless, do you think it was rash for him to say that in the first year of his presidency he would meet with people like Hugo Chavez or Mahmoud Ahmadinejad?
You know, Neil, what's so interesting about the kinds of questions that I'm often asked about Senator Obama is people have an assumption that somehow he's taken these positions that were rash or naive. And I think it's worth really delving into the record. When you think about the decisions that he's made and the ways in which they were perceived at the time, and then you look at what has actually happened in terms of the Bush administration's actions, the rhetoric of his opponents, the conventional wisdom coming around, I would argue he has influenced the foreign policy debate in ways that are really unprecedented. So start with his opposition to the Iraq War, which at the time was a politically costly position to take. It was a position that he has sustained. He was the first to call for a timetable, and now where are we? The Iraqi government and the Bush administration are working towards a timetable for withdrawal. When you think about Afghanistan, Barack Obama was one of the first to be pointing out that we had really lost our strategic focus as a country in the war on terror, that we were neglecting Afghanistan and the border with Pakistan at our peril, and that we really needed to keep our eye on the fight, and we needed to send not only more troops, but really recraft a whole different strategy there. And now that's what everyone, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is saying. If you look at Pakistan, Barack Obama pointed out the dangers of unqualifiedly supporting President Musharraf and ignoring the underpinnings of a democratic society. He called for a new relationship. He said we should condition aid. Well, where are we now? We have a new democratically elected leader. Musharraf is gone, and we're hopefully going to be rethinking our aid policy. Finally, the piece about talking with Iran is part of a broader construct that Senator Obama has illustrated to be consistent with American foreign policy principles. That is to say, you shouldn't be afraid to talk to those with whom you disagree, even when you know they may hate you. It's a very smart way to figure out what your options are, what motivates them, and to strengthen your hand diplomatically when you pursue other options, whether they're sanctions or ultimately the use of force. So, you know, in all of these respects, he was taking positions that people sort of suggested were naive. And in fact, they've become, as with the case of Iran and the administration beginning to begin that dialogue, the change in Pakistan, the refocus on Afghanistan, the timetable in Iraq, they've become the conventional wisdom and in some cases the policies of the Bush administration. So I think the real question is, why haven't people recognized the extraordinary judgment that this individual has shown in foreign policy?
One of the criticisms the McCain campaign would make is that, the beginning of the war, okay, he did oppose the beginning of the war. He also opposed the surge, argued vehemently against it, said it was the wrong policy at the wrong time, and you can make of it what you will. It's certainly not the only factor that has helped turn things around in Iraq, but it is certainly one of the factors that helped turn things around in Iraq.
Well, you know, that's another interesting case where people have really redefined the bar for what success in the surge means. If, you know, Barack Obama has said that General Petraeus has done a magnificent job with the help of incredible courage and talent on the part of our forces in reducing civilian casualties in the Baghdad area. Absolutely. He's very proud of that. But if you remember the original impetus for the surge, it was to enable a different method of reconciliation and to fundamentally change the political equation in Iraq, and that hasn't happened. So while he's very impressed by the role that American forces have played and impressed by the leadership that General Petraeus showed in turning that situation around, as you said, there were many factors, including Muqtadir al-Sadr's position, the Sons of Iraq coming around and changing their role in the fight. But more importantly, the fundamental measure of merit, which was political transformation, hasn't occurred. And the only way to do that, Senator Obama argues, is to make it clear that we're going to be withdrawing U.S. forces, but we have to do it as responsibly as possible and be as responsible getting out as we were irresponsible getting in.
We've asked listeners to call and make their best case for Barack Obama, their final argument on foreign policy, 800-989-8255. You can also weigh in by email, talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Rich, and Rich is on the line with us from Rochester in New York.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
I think she laid out a very good case for Obama, but I think Barack Obama is a very conciliatory person. George Bush came in to the White House with very strong and I think pretty ignorant views of the world. I think Barack Obama has a much more inclusive view of the world. He has a willingness to work with the UN, and the UN is, if you ask me, is strength is directly proportional to the support that it gets from the U.S. and its allies. And also, I think his willingness to work very closely with the European Union and to recognize when we should and should not be using preemptive force. In fact, I think he's basically against preemptive force. I think those are several of the things that have been tossed to the side by the Bush White House. They've almost acted in a bully-like fashion with the world. They told the world we don't need you until there's a situation that we need them, then we go begging. I think we should always start working the rest of the world, and if the situation warrants it, then we go on our own. But I think we've gone really backwards, and I think that has hurt our standing in the world.
Sometimes, Rich, the unilateralism of the Bush administration is a bit overstated, and sometimes the multilateralism of the Barack Obama campaign can be overstated. But there's no question, Sarah Sewell, that Barack Obama, much more of a multilateralist.
Well, I think, you know, Rich is onto an even deeper point, which really has to do with the temperament and judgment that Barack Obama brings to the position of commander-in-chief. And he sees things in the long term, you know, none of this short-term feel-good, you know, lash out, but create a much bigger set of problems for the nation to deal with afterwards. He is fundamentally concerned with what will work in the long term, not just what will satisfy domestic political sensibilities in the short term, and he really thinks about problems in an integrated way, which is, I think, why Rich was talking about a predisposition to recognize the value of allies and partnerships in doing the very important security work that needs to occur on behalf not just of Americans, but of the larger community as well. He's also someone who thinks about second and third order effects, which is why, you know, he is concerned about energy not simply as a question of the health of the economy. And that's indeed the health of the economy, he's argued, is a central part of the health of our security policy, but also because the dependence that we have on foreign oil fundamentally affects our foreign policy. So these are all important aspects of how he looks at the world and makes his decisions that really, I think, gives him the tenor of judgment that we need and his temperament, which is steady and focused and mature, and I think in stark contrast to some others on the political stage, which tend to be erratic and distracted. I mean, he has a pragmatism and a sense of the grayness and the nuance of the world that is precisely what we need in a leader for this century.
Rich, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
So long. The United States government, this present administration, has recently been launching a series of missile strikes on suspected terrorist bases in western part of Pakistan. Across the border, there was also one raid by U.S. forces carried in by helicopter there, which prompted strong protests from Islamabad. Recently, the United States Special Forces apparently carried out a similar anti-terrorist raid into Syria. Barack Obama has said that he might be tempted to go into western Pakistan, if necessary, to go after Osama bin Laden, if the Pakistani forces were unable or unwilling to do that themselves. How would an Obama administration be different from the policy that we're seeing now?
Well, what Senator Obama has said about Pakistan is considerably more nuanced, I think. I mean, it's very clear, and he's reiterated the point that both Syria and Pakistan have obligations as nation states for the activity that occurs within their borders. But his view about Pakistan is really much more complex than simply seeing it as a question of strikes against the border. But I want to make a distinction. This is another point on which Barack Obama has been criticized, but I think extremely naively criticized, which is he said that if we have actionable intelligence against senior leadership of al-Qaeda and the Pakistani government is unable or unwilling to act, we will. And those kinds of criticisms levied against him for saying that he would act to take action against those who masterminded and carried out the 9/11 attacks, I think bespeaks a fundamental oddity about the kinds of criticisms that are leveled at him. His view about Pakistan is one in which we have to forge a new partnership, one in which we don't provide a blank check, some $10 billion worth of aid since 9/11 in pursuing this strategic partnership without a lot to show for it. Senator Obama's view is that Pakistan has to be reinvigorated and convinced of the need to take action to secure its borders, and that that's a very important piece of securing American interests in combating al-Qaeda.
We're talking with Sarah Sewell, a senior foreign policy advisor to the Obama campaign and on the director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University, making her final argument for Barack Obama on foreign policy. Tomorrow, Lawrence Eagleburger, former Secretary of State for John McCain. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get Wayne on the line. Wayne with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hello, how are you?
Well, thank you. Go ahead, Wayne.
My final argument is for actually leaving Iraq, and that is the major focus of the foreign policy. Iraq is the major recruiting tool for those who would want to harm us around the world, and our occupation there ending would be a great tool for ending that recruitment. Also, sitting down and talking with countries that are trying to acquire nuclear weapons, this administration took the stance that it wasn't going to talk to anyone, and that hasn't worked in any efforts to quit nuclear proliferation. And then in the recent weeks, they actually did some talking with North Korea, and we made some progress. So that line of reasoning seems like it will increase our standing around the world.
And Sarah Sewell, if you would, I'd like to specifically get into Iraq, where the Bush administration, again, is negotiating a status of forces agreement that would require the withdrawal of American forces by the end of 2011. Is that a timetable that an Obama administration would be satisfied with? Barack Obama, I'm sorry. We're looking for an answer from Sarah Sewell, Wayne. I apologize. Go ahead, Ms. Sewell.
Well, what Barack Obama has said is that we cannot solve the political problems in Iraq and that we need to focus their minds on doing precisely that. The only way to do that is to begin a drawdown that, in his view, would be significantly faster than that, but also retain a residual force that would carry out core missions, including the protection of embassies. And so his view of the whole Iraq situation is one in which Iraq is not unimportant, but we have to recognize the limits of our ability to fix Iraq. And he as he said to General Petraeus, his responsibility as commander-in-chief is not to think simply about Iraq, but to think about the overall strategic posture of the country and the overall security of the nation. And by that calculation, the amount of treasure that is being spent in Iraq, even as the Iraqis sit on tens of billions of dollars of surplus for which they are not spending their own money on reconstruction, the amount of focus of our foreign policy and the amount of enmity that we've incurred on the part of other states by virtue of our posture in Iraq all indicate that a strategic view of American interests demands that we begin our exit from Iraq immediately. And the difference between Senator Obama and President Bush and John McCain is that they're tactical, and they are willing to focus at this at the expense of our larger strategic interests.
Sarah Sewell, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Sarah Sewell, Faculty Director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard and a Senior Policy Advisor to the Obama campaign. Tomorrow, as we mentioned, Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger, the former Secretary of State, will join us to make the case for John McCain based on his foreign policy agenda. And before we sign off today, this is our last regular broadcast from the museum. I want to take a minute to say thank you to all the people here for their hospitality and for making our weekly visits possible. Jack Hurley and Susan Bennett, Deputy Directors of the museum, also Shelby Coffey and Jim Updike. We also had a great team working for us in the studio, Walt Hassett, Dennis Dunbar, and Tim Lawrence, and of course our team of engineers from NPR who make sure we always sound our best, Drew Reynolds, Melissa Marquis, Kevin Waite, and Dennis Nielsen. We will be back here at the museum next Thursday, though, for a special broadcast, Talk of the World, and back in Studio 3A next Wednesday to wrap up the results of the presidential election. So join us then, and in fact, join us tomorrow from Studio 3A. I'm Neil Conan at the museum in Washington, D.C., and this is NPR News.